Oxford Sparks Podcast, Episode 5, Anomalies, Part 3.
You know, my view would be we should just change the word.
This is Irene Tracy.
I'm a neuroscientist.
And she has a problem with the word placebo.
My particular area of interest and expertise is using brain imaging to look at the human brain, to understand how it works, and particularly to understand how it produces painful experiences.
Her problem lies with its association with fakery.
The very word itself is from Latin, mean I will please, and it is from the Christian Vespers when people were mourning.
Placebos were traditionally prayers recited during the mourning process.
How it got sort of warped into then being used as in a pejorative sense, that this meant fakery, was during that sort of 12th century, 13th century period, mourners would be paid to go out and mourn for people who had died. They were obviously not really mourning, they were fakers.
These so-called fakers came to be known as placebos.
And so it sort of took hold in this pejorative sense that if there was some sort of fakery or no truth to it, it was a placebo.
Today, we commonly use the word in medicine, usually in relation to fake or inert treatments, and most clinical trials will compare drugs against a placebo, such as a sugar pill. Because of this association, the placebo effect has taken on a rather mysterious and mystical persona. But in order to get past this and see it for what it really is, a very normal part of our neurological pain system, we need to understand more about what pain is and how it's created.
Acute pain's good, so that's the good warning system. You know, to have acute pain is a great thing because it tells you hurt. I must look after myself and let tissue healing do its business. It tells you to remember what caused that and don't touch it again. So as children, you know, we learn not to put our fingers in a candle flame. We learn not to touch a pan on a hot stove.
For example, if you were to bash your big toe.
Of all the sensory experiences we have and emotional experiences, it's one that's what we call very multifactorial. So it's not just the sensory, ouch, it's my big toe, I've stubbed it. You attend to it, you have a sort of visceral emotional reaction to it, you remember what caused that, so you avoid it in the future. Most of the other sensory experiences we have, like
hearing, taste, smell, sight, and touch,
we're very clear which bits of the brain process those at a very fundamental, primitive level, and that again is shared across species. We still haven't quite got that, even for pain, considering it's the oldest and probably one of the most important.
So although we know the why for this question of pain, we don't fully understand the how.
We still haven't got that nailed. So that's just a really fundamental, basic neuroscience question. This sort of very subjective, this very private, unique to you experience of how that particular damage affects you and what level of pain and the quality of pain and how that affects you and what you're going to do about it is a very individual thing.
Personality, anxiety, mood, everyone's brain puts pain together in a slightly different way.
All these things will very powerfully alter how those signals are processed and thereby very powerfully influence the actual pain that they experience. So the same person could be experiencing the same thing in the environment that's causing that trigger, but they might have two quite different pain experiences.
Brain imaging techniques are now helping us to unravel some of the neurological complexity that can underpin pain generation.
As we do as scientists, we take a very big concept like pain, and then we break it down into its constituent parts and try and very carefully control different features of it to understand. The actual step that the patient or you would take to describe that pain to me, using your language and your cultural influences, and is a different journey. And we're not imaging that. We're imaging the brain as an organ that's receiving those signals, processing them. And that's what we've done a lot of work on over the years, using brain imaging to actually look inside people's brains whilst they're experiencing pain. And then we might manipulate people's moods, people's attention, other aspects that we know will change the way the brain is going to process that same signal and powerfully illustrate to the subject, but also through the brain imaging, how that changes the brain representation and therefore the experience that they have.
And this is the key point. The effect of manipulating somebody and changing their belief state can have a real effect on their perception of pain.
So we've been able to design experiments where we control that and very convincingly prove that these features, which would have, I think, historically been thought of as just influencing the way the person describes their pain, really powerfully change the physiology and the neurochemistry. And that's really important to show, because it means that you've got new ways that you can maybe try and help a patient with their pain by saying, if you can control these aspects, or we can improve these aspects or target those aspects, that will actually directly do as much as actually trying to take away the thing on the big toe that's sending the signal in the first place.
So what does all this mean for the placebo effect? Well, if you think about it, a placebo is really just another type of manipulation.
You're manipulating their expectations, and you can of course do that in two ways. You can change their expectations for the better or for the worse. So the better would be a placebo response, and the worse would be a nocebo. It's really only since we've had some of our more recent non-invasive tools to look inside the body in the past 20 years have we been able to actually answer the question whether these effects are real, in the sense, are they physiological? And unequivocally, they are.
And in the case of pain relief, the placebo effect is just a normal part of your pain system going about its business, responding to incoming information to control the level of pain you need in any given situation.
So what it does is it harnesses exactly the same neural system which you use when you're distracted from pain. So classic example is the fight or flight response, or, you know, in a situation of battle or war or sports, high arousal, you know, you don't feel the pain because you've got this incredible top-down system to just block it, because it's more important to get the goal or to get away from the lion that's bitten half your leg off rather than be writhing in agony because the lion's going to kill you. You get away, and then, of course, the system releases and the floodgates open. Ouch, I've got half a leg bitten off, or my ear's been bitten off in the scrum, or whatever it is. And what's really interesting is placebo analgesia, it uses that system. There's nothing mechanistically special. It's just using these inherent systems in the brain that are there evolutionary for those reasons, which is why I'm saying we should stop using the word, because it's pejorative, it's got all this negative connotation, and so therefore it really is time to rethink whether that's the correct word we should be using for it.
The task facing the medical profession now is understanding how best to exploit this.
It's all about managing expectations. And again, those experiments we've done where we've actually given people, you know, drugs, morphine, but we've manipulated their expectations, and we've shown how powerfully a change in people's expectations can completely nullify an IV dose of morphine.
In unravelling the complexity behind the brain's control of pain, we're realising it's not just the drugs or the treatments that we provide that influence pain relief. A patient's outcome depends on the entire experience that all of these things are wrapped up in. With that in mind, do doctors have their work cut out in manipulating patient expectations?
It's certainly more complex than we thought, but I guess, you know, I'm an optimist, so one tends to look at it on the sort of, it's more opportunities. So the fact that, again, some of the tools that they have come out of our lab have shown just how capable the brain is of rewiring itself and learning new things is a wonderful opportunity. You know, sharing that and making sure that people realise, yeah, you know, learn something new, take up a new activity. You know, these things really genuinely have a beneficial effect, not just on how you feel, but just on your brain, and it will make it more resilient going forwards, is a wonderful thing to know. It's sure, it makes it more complex, but that's okay. We would look at it more as more opportunity.
You've been listening to the Oxford Sparks podcast, narrated by me, Chris Lintott, and produced by Ed Prosser. You can find a full list of credits and much else besides on our website at oxfordsparks.net.